Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Got a very, very nice show for you today. Second hour, one of our favorite people will be here. We're going to do Ask a Priest with Father Matthew, and you can call and ask whatever you would, whether you're Catholic or not, if you've got a question you've thought, I've always wanted to ask a Catholic priest that. We'll do that second hour. Father Matthew Spencer will be our guest. The number is 888-318-7884. And by the way, if you're not Catholic, you can call anytime here. We love talking with folks who are not Catholic. We love talking about the Catholic faith with anybody. This hour, you know, you hear us talk about on the air, and you hear as a Catholic person, as a Christian person, you're going to hear about the Church Fathers, about this word patristics, and sometimes we might slightly take for granted that people know exactly what we're talking about and what all that means when we're talking about the Church Fathers, so to speak. So we're going to do an hour on that, and if you've got questions, whether they are more advanced questions or absolute beginner questions on the Church Fathers, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Dr. John Pepino is our guest. He's the professor of Greek, Latin, history, and patristics at Our Lady of Guadalupe Seminary in Nebraska. That's the seminary of the Fraternity of St. Peter. And he's going to be teaching a free course for the Institute of Catholic Culture, the wonderful Institute of Catholic Culture. So throughout the hour, we'll let you know where you can sign up for that free course. It's Patristics 102, the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers. Dr. John Pepino, thank you very much for being here with us.
I'm very glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me to your program.
Oh, we're just delighted to have you, and I'm glad we get a chance to talk about this, because I think sometimes we say Church Fathers, and we don't even consider the fact that, well, there's probably a lot of people who don't know who we're talking about. So maybe I could just start with the most basic question. What is a Church Father?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because sometimes, you know, just in daily talk, they're invoked nearly as though they were inspired by the Holy Ghost in the way that the writers of the Bible were, yeah. Right? And so people, well, so-and-so, St. Augustine, St. Cyprian, St. John Chrysostom, father of the church, says X, and that's supposed to put an end to the conversation. Okay, well, I guess I'll have to believe that. And it's a bit more nuanced and complicated than that. So yes, let's answer that question you asked. What is a father of the church? And traditionally, they have been given four notes. Antiquity, I'll go over these in detail in a moment, meaning the time when they lived and write and preached. Orthodoxy, they can't be heretics, obviously. Their holiness of life, these were holy men, saints. And then the fact that they have been approved by the church as fathers. So let me unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
Now, when we speak of antiquity, we mean Christian writers who succeeded, from those who succeeded to the apostles directly. So the apostles we don't usually call fathers of the church, but their disciples. So, for example, St. Polycarp was a disciple of St. John, the evangelist. So was St. Ignatius of Antioch. Those would be, or St. Clement of Rome was a disciple of Saints Peter and St. Clement of Rome was a disciple of Saints Peter and Paul at Rome. So these are the very second generation, if you like. So those are the first fathers of the church, and then their disciples, and the disciples of their disciples, and going down the line through the centuries. So second century, you get to the third century, you have great figures like St. Justin Martyr. Well, second century, yes. Third century, you get people like St. Cyprian. And then the fourth century, the golden age of patristics with St. Athanasius and St. Basil, St. Gregory of Nazianzus, Ambrose, Jerome, Augustine, all the great names that you know. Then you go down into the fifth century, so some late Jerome, and then other fathers like St. Eucherius isn't so well known, and St. Cyril of Alexandria. And then into the sixth century, seventh century, and early even eighth, early ninth. So you get to, at one point, you get to St. Gregory the Great in the 600s. And then by the 700s, for the East, you get to St. John of Damascus, mm-hmm. who had been a public servant in the Caliphate. So you see, we go from the Roman Empire persecuting Christians in the second century, those fathers, through the legalization of Christianity in the early 4th century, you get St. Athanasius and all those great. And then after the Roman Empire, in the Caliphate, St. John of Damascus, who defends veneration of the icons in the 700s. And in the West, it comes down to St. Isidore of Seville, who lived through the conversion of the Arian Visigothic nobility, kings, and clergy to Catholicism, and after whom the Muslims came to Spain. So that's the broad sweep of what we mean by the antiquity of the fathers. And then there's kind of a break after that. I mean, you do have later theologians, Paschasius Radbertus, Notke, and others, and then you go into scholasticism, and there's a different story altogether. Orthodoxy. Now, you have to be careful with this particular note, because these men were Orthodox to the best of their knowledge and always inclined to think with the church, but they were not free from error. And that's where you have to be careful when you're quoting, when someone gives you just a little snippet or quotation from a father of the church, that should not end the conversation. You should, well, that's a very good quotation. Let's study the whole context. And sometimes even, so I'll give you one of the most famous examples. And it's famous because St. Augustine, in fact, uses it as an example of the father who can be mistaken. St. Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage during the persecution of Emperor Decius, 250s AD. Terrible situation. And there were heresies, as always. And he, St. Cyprian, believed that you had to be a member in good standing of the Catholic Church to be able to give a valid baptism. And he has very good arguments for this. If you knock on the Ark of Noah, you drown. How can you give what you don't have, and so forth? And so all these people baptized by heretical ministers, all of them, without exception, he would consider to be not validly baptized, right?
Right.
And he even had a local council in Carthage there in North Africa. All the bishops agreed with him. But when they sent the minutes of their synod of Carthage to Rome, the Pope answered back, Pope St. Stephen, and said, my dear Cyprian, you're wrong on this. In Rome, in Alexandria, and elsewhere, we accept people who've been baptized by heretics. They just have to recant their heresy. We impose our hands on them. But that baptism was indeed valid. So they do. You'll see mistakes like that crop up, and you can't let it rattle you.
So
you see what I mean?
I do see what you mean. So I'm wondering about, because I believe I've actually heard this is the case among some of the fathers. They might give an explanation of the Trinity, for example, that would have been acceptable in their time because definitions were less precise. But then later, the definitions became more precise. And they, like you said, they were trying to be Orthodox. They weren't attempting to be heretical in any way. And right. In their time, they were not heretics. But we shouldn't go back and say, well, they're right and the later definition of the church is wrong.
No, that's right, because they're really struggling with the mystery. So when you're trying to explain the Trinity, how do you explain it? And this is tough stuff to explain. I mean, you can hardly blame them. And it took many councils really to refine exactly the language that expresses the mystery as closely as possible, which is what ecumenical councils are for. So you will find a St. Justin Martyr, who lives in the 160s, astounding, brilliant, beautiful writer, convert, who seems to say that the Son is less than the Father.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
Or you get even... some ambiguous writers like Origen, who may or may not be a father of the church, we can get into that, who in a debate said, well, the Son is like another God. Do you see what he's trying to do? He's trying to say that he's fully God like the Father, but to call him another God seems to say, well, there's more. Then we don't believe in one God anymore. We believe in at least two.
Yeah.
But he's just, and later on he said, well, I spoke too quickly there when I said that. So, yes, we can't hold them up to the standard of theologians who have the benefit of 20 centuries of ecumenical definitions at ecumenical councils. That's absolutely the case. And so that's where you have to be a little bit careful with the fathers. And there was a period in the 20th century where it was very fashionable to quote this or that father to advance your own particular theological hobby horse.
Yes.
And people were not trained to say, well, hang on, okay, that one father may have said that, but that doesn't win the argument. And people say, oh, okay, yeah, all right. if he said, and so what I mean, and so a lot of things were imposed upon the people of God through a misapplication of what really is a science, the science of patristics, by which we mean the correct use of the fathers of the church in theological reflection. So and I may get back to that actually, but
okay. So, but you had four kind of marks or signs,
right.
And there was antiquity, which you covered, orthodoxy.
Yes.
At least orthodoxy of intention.
Yes.
And so what were the other two?
So then there was holiness and church approval. Oh, yeah. So holiness would be, were these people in fact saints? And generally speaking, the fathers of the church are saints. And I incline to think that they were all saints. Or another way to put it is that if an ecclesiastical writer is not a saint of the church, he may have antiquity, he may have some orthodoxy, but if he's not a saint, he's not a father of the church, I don't think.
Okay.
And so men like Tertullian, yep. who seems to have died in heresy, certainly lived the end of his life in a weird cultic heresy, kind of a David Koresh type of thing, okay? And then even Origen, I don't think count as fathers of the church, although reading Origen is very important, and in the course I give on the pre-Nicene fathers, we spend two lectures on Origen. He's worth reading and studying, but he doesn't count as a father of the church.
And then
he's not Saint Origen.
Finally, they need the approval of the church.
Yes. Now that is very, very fuzzy.
Yeah.
Why? Because the title of church, a father of the church, is not a liturgical title like virgin or holy woman or confessor or bishop. You know, there when yeah. there's a feast in the church, there's no common of a father of the church. There's commons of doctors of the church, but not fathers of the church. Never does the Pope proclaim someone to be a father of the church. Now, they do proclaim doctors of the church, right? Mm-hmm. But they never proclaim father. So where do you find this church approval? And it's undefined, and it's kind of tradition and custom. And it usually is, well, in the great patrologies, which are works on the fathers of the church that kind of talk about them and collect them. If they're in there, well, then they're a father of the church. And it's just sort of a list that's been handed on really since Saint Jerome, himself a father of the church. He wrote a book called On Illustrious Men, and where he made a catalog, because by now there had been enough fathers that you could start looking back, mm-hmm. right? Ignatius and Clement didn't have fathers of the church to rely on because they were the first ones. But you got to a critical mass. Okay, now we've got all these writings. And so Saint Jerome, the first one, wrote this book on illustrious men with a list. And then that list, of course, got added. He was added to it after his death, naturally. And from then on, there have been patrologies and series of patristics and things. And it's kind of understood, although it's fuzzy enough that people disagree. Some may say that they believe Origen does count as a father of the church. It's a respectable opinion.
Dr. John Pepino is our guest. We'll talk a little bit about the free course he's doing starting this month for the Institute of Catholic Culture. That's the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers. But we're just talking in general about the fathers of the church. There's a couple lines still open, 888-318-7884. We have to take a very quick break. When I come back, I want to ask you, Dr. Pepino, okay, they're ancient, they're holy and all that, but they can be wrong. So why should we care what these ancient holy people had to say? I'll ask you that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father John Trigilio. We need Catholic Radio because it is a lifeline to Holy Mother Church. Catholic Radio enables us to know what the Church teaches, but also to have solidarity with one another. It is one way that we express our commonality, our communio, that we are family, and by staying together, we can be God's children here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am very much enjoying the conversation we're having with Dr. John Pepino. The class that it's coming up, it's a free course. Anybody in the world can sign up and learn about the Nicene. That's the fathers of the Nicene period and then the post-Nicene fathers. You just go to instituteofcatholicculture.org and find out all about it. The registration closes tomorrow, actually. Well, I just realized that's tomorrow. And the class starts on July 25th. And so what a fun thing to do for the summer, learn about the fathers of the church from Dr. John Pepino, who can tell you all about them, read them in their languages and tell you all about them, and very much worth, I'll tell you what, I'm about to say very much worth knowing, but that was the question I left with. Why are they important to us if they're not infallible? What does invoking them and having them there do for us?
Right. That's a very good question. I mean, you might say, well, all I need is the Bible and the solemnly defined dogmas of the church, and I'm done, you know. So why read them? Now, I'll answer in two ways. One, from the really sort of strictly scholarship, theological point of view, and then from the point of view of the ordinary Christian, or even, for that matter, non-Christian who has an interest. So in terms of theologians, the fathers of the church are important because they're witnesses to what the faith is. And the traditional doctrine regarding their importance is that if there is a consensus of the fathers in a matter of faith and morals, then that is part of the deposit of faith. It is part of the tradition of revelation, you see. And so theologians, when they compose their arguments from scripture, from reason, and then from tradition, it is often on the consensus of the fathers or the near consensus, the virtual consensus, there are nuances there, that they rely to show, look, this is what has been handed down. All of the fathers, the majority of the fathers, let's say, or the important fathers, all state this as a matter of faith. Therefore, it's part of the deposit. So they do have their role to play there.
Number one. Yeah. Go. Okay. Yeah. There's more numbers.
So one or the other might make the odd mistake here, but as a consensus,
right.
I mean, how could there be a consensus on a mistake among all these well-known holy men whom everyone looked up to? When they make mistakes, well, they're called to account. But if they all consent to the same doctrine, well, then there has to be a true doctrine of the faith. So that's one aspect. But for everyone else, let's say for the Christian, it is so, dare I say, sweet in a way to read these men who clearly were in love with Christ, it's on every page, discuss that. And there'll be sometimes these are letters that they write, the very early Christian documents, just like, you know, St. Paul and St. Peter, they wrote letters. So St. Ignatius, for example, you read his letters. And there's just a sort of an unction there in recognizing in a man who was evangelized back then by St. John the Evangelist, and to recognize our own thoughts, our own yearnings, and our own love for God in such different circumstances. So there's that. Also, the edifying examples they give to us. And lastly, and this is an aspect of patristics, or the study of the fathers, that used to be a little bit neglected, but over the past 20-odd years has really come into its own, is the help they can give us in understanding Scripture in a spiritually nourishing way. And that we're going to do a bit of that in this course. In fact, when we read St. Jerome, we'll read excerpts of his commentary on the book of Jonah. And in the last course, the way we did the pre-Nicene Fathers, the anti-Nicene Fathers, we read Origen, his commentaries, the way in which he commented on Scripture, which was so influential in understanding the deeper spiritual meaning of what the Bible is telling us. And so there's so much to be learned from them for our own meditation. I would recommend to, you know, when you, that spiritual reading, when you, you know, to your holy hour or your hour, your adoration slot, or at home with your family, is to read the Bible and then what the fathers say about the passage you just read. And there's no end to it. You will never run out of the depth and breadth and height of spiritual understanding of the Bible with the fathers.
Again, the number is 888-318-7884. Dr. John Pepino is our guest. He's professor of Greek, Latin history, and patristics at Our Lady of Guadalupe Seminary in Nebraska. And he's here to talk about the Church Fathers. If you've got questions about the Church Fathers, you are welcome here. 888-318-7884. I would like to go get some calls on with you. I've got more questions of my own, but the lines are just about full. How about we take some calls?
Sounds good.
All right. Let's go to Tim in Connecticut, listening on KVSS Radio. Tim, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Pepino.
Hi. Thank you very much, Dr. Pepino. The question I have is regarding St. Jerome and his revisiting, if you will, the word that the Lord used in the Our Father, which was not meant to be the daily bread, our daily bread, but epiousion, supersubstantial or beyond substance bread. Why was that not really reestablished, or why is it out of favor today? Because it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater as we celebrate the National Congress, Eucharistic Congress. I mean, that was such an essential teaching and the truth that the Lord created those words to represent his presence, and it's gone. And how do we accept that?
All right, Tim.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Tim. Yeah, that is an interesting question. And of course, since St. Jerome was, the great translator or retranslator or editor of the Bible into Latin, he paid very close attention to the words on the page. Now, the word epiousion, so the Our Father occurs in two versions, right, in the Gospels. It occurs in two places. And in both places in the Greek, it says epiousion. Now, the word epiousion in Greek is itself an extremely rare word, and therefore it's difficult to ascertain its precise meaning. And so for that reason, St. Jerome said, okay, I'm going to give, for each of the Our Fathers that are found in the Gospels, I'm going to use a different Latin translation. In one, he used quotidianum, daily. And the other one, super substantialem, which replicates the literal, it's like a calc. Epi is super, upon, and usion is substantial, substantialem, super substantial, so super substantial. And so he said, we're going to go with both. And in fact, if you look at one of the early editions, anyway, of the Douay-Rheims version of the Bible in English, they followed suit. One Our Father has daily, and the other one has supersubstantial. And what is the meaning of that supersubstantial? Well, clearly it's interpreted as being this bread whose substance is above that which the eyes perceive, as Tim indicated. So it's a wonderful topic of for sermons, and Tim is quite right that people should be more aware of it. But epiousion also, it's not a mistranslation to say daily, as plain as that may be. And to continue with that, with the fathers and this prayer, when the fathers discuss prayer, they discuss that prayer, the Lord's Prayer. Tertullian does it, St. Cyprian does it, others do it too. And when they get to that word, the word daily, they spend a lot of time, well, what is meant by daily? And again, Tim, this is what contact with the fathers really teaches one, is that words may have more than one meaning. And St. Thomas Aquinas, in fact, early in his Summa, says, are we to understand the Bible in various ways? And he ends up with the answer, yes, there's a multiplicity of ways. And that word daily has many possible different meanings. It does include the meaning, the daily bread you have, you know, when you're eating your pot roast in the evening, you know, to pick up the sauce. It does mean simply that. And so it does also mean just regular nourishment that really is a gift of God. Right? Behold the birds and the lilies. And then it also has that meaning, give us this day our super substantial bread, meaning the Eucharist, meaning the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our dear Lord Jesus Christ. It means all of these things together. And that's why St. Jerome decided to go with both. And the fathers all sort of go along with that when they discuss that word.
What a wonderful question, Tim. Thank you very, very much. The fact that we have these scriptures in human words, but there are like that word epiousios. How often is it used? Is it like you said? It's extremely rare. Even a Greek speaker might not know what it means.
Yes, it was. You look it up in the big Greek dictionaries, and it shows up a couple of times in all of the body of Greek literature.
Wow! Wow! Tim, thank you. A wonderful question for conversation. We've got more calls, and I've got more of my questions for Dr. John Pepino on the Fathers of the Church. 888-318-7884. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Matt Swaim here. Join us for the Best of the Sunrise Morning Show with summer reading suggestions, pilgrimage ideas, and tips for incorporating your faith into summer activities. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, I want to ask you again, if you have a testimonial about what Catholic Answers has meant to you or your family, we'd love to hear it. We do share them. We share them with donors, we share them with supporters, and we share them with the folks who work here. And they mean a lot to us. You can just go to CatholicAnswersLive.com, click the red testimonial button, and share. If maybe the folks here, one of the apologists or the books or whatever, have brought you back to the church or helped a relative or whatever it is. If you have a testimonial, we would be grateful if you would share it with us. CatholicAnswersLive.com, click the red testimonial button. And let me say again that if you want to take this course with our guest, Dr. John Pepino, you got to move because the registration closes tomorrow. So today or tomorrow, go to Institute of Catholic Culture, instituteofcatholicculture.org, and sign up. And it'll start next week on July 25th. The orientation is next week, and then the class begins on August 1st. Learn all about a long period of the Fathers of the Church with Dr. John Pepino. On the line, we got a whole bunch of folks. I want to go back and let them ask Dr. Pepino their questions. Lou is in Michigan, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Lou, thank you for your call. Go ahead, please, with your question.
Thank you. Hi, Doctor. Could you elaborate on why Origen is not a church father, and in particular his ideas about hell?
Yes, well, you sound well informed there, because that's precisely one of the reasons he's not a church father. So Origen was a Platonist. They all were, or Neoplatonist in those days. And he had the kind of brain that just never goes off and goes really a mind a minute. He was a very brilliant writer. However, his mind got away from him sometimes. And so this is where he went off the rails, and for which, in fact, his doctrines were condemned in council. So that's why he's not a father of the church. And this is what he believed, and I'll get to particularly to the infernal regions. He believed that our souls pre-exist our own conception. So we're created in heaven, and we were just disembodied souls contemplating God. But then all of us here, who turn away from God, kind of cooled off and fell into a body. And Adam and Eve were the first. And in fact, he interpreted Adam and Eve as not being created with bodies and being given bodies only when they fell. And that is represented in the Bible by wearing animal skins. That merely meant that their souls then became embodied. And that happens to all of us. And then if we do evil and don't follow God here on earth, then there is a hell that we go down to. He does say that. And Satan's down there, by the way, and so are the demons. But then he believes that just as we here on earth can turn back to God, live good lives of holiness, and go back to heaven, so too can the people downstairs. So you can come back up, and then from the infernal regions to this realm, he calls it the nether world, to our world, which is just the nether world, and then back to the upper world. And at the end of time, in Origen's view, behold, I make all things perfect, right? These are the words that Christ used. He's quoted in Revelation, in Apocalypse with that. For Origen, at the end of time, all rational creatures, whether men or fallen angels, will be reconciled to God, and there'll be no place of eternal punishment in the end. There's a fancy word for that, apokatastasis, and that was the teaching of Origen. And it's especially the pre-existence of souls that got him into trouble. With the business of people in the lower world being able to somehow come back again, my impression is that he's grappling with the idea of purgatory, but he's misled himself with an excessive reliance on Neoplatonism, if you see what I mean. And this notion of the empty hell was resurrected by readers of Origen in the 20s and 30s, people like Henri de Lubac and his two students, Danielou and von Balthasar, the new theologians, were kind of exploring what Origen might have been onto there. And that's why you have it even today in that particular school of theology, this idea that, well, maybe hell is empty after all. Yeah. So that's the long story there for you, Lou.
Okay, Lou?
Was there any defense of him because he was so early and really didn't have the maybe all the information or the previous church fathers to rely on? Did anybody defend him that way? Because wasn't he in the late 100s, early 200s?
No, Origen wrote in the 250s.
250s, and okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he died shortly thereafter, I think 254. So he's writing in the 200s, early 200s. No, he... You see, it's not like Cyprian in his case, I don't think. He was so off with respect to the pre-existence of souls. Now, he's so brilliant, though. This is the thing. And he wrote so much that the bishop, because people ask this, well, why wasn't he condemned in his lifetime by his own bishop there in Alexandria? Why did the bishops of Palestine keep inviting him to give sermons? It's because there's so much gold with Origen. There's so much there that's good that no one really wanted to condemn. For those he was actually condemned for other reasons, but not doctrinally in his own lifetime. And he was followed by men like St. Ambrose, was a big fan of Origen. St. Jerome, big fan of Origen. St. Jerome's friend at the time, Rufinus, big fan of Origen, until someone decided to make a list of all the heresies and heretics that existed. And Origen was put on there. And then suddenly there was the dam broke. And the dirty little secret that everyone knew that Origen also was off his rocker in some aspects, that dam broke, and then suddenly everyone had to back off and say, no, I've never liked Origen after all. And the same Rufinus translated a work by Origen and purposefully quoted all the good that St. Jerome had said about Origen, and then Rufinus went from being a friend to being an enemy of Jerome, who wrote a book called Against Rufinus. So there was kind of a break there in the late 4th century, I beg your pardon, where suddenly everyone kind of turned on Origen, and ultimately he was condemned for his views on the pre-existence of souls, and then for views which he may or may not have held as well. There's something called Origenism, where some of his disciples went even further with some wacky ideas, of which the wackiest, I think, is that the resurrected bodies that we shall have, the glorified bodies we'll have out of the resurrection, will be perfect in shape, and the perfect shape is the sphere. Oh. And so we shall all, yeah, so we'll be beach balls at the end of time, okay?
I'm halfway there already.
I know, I'm working on it too. Yeah. So there was a moment. But it is an interesting test case, Lou, and I encourage you to read more about it. That where Origen was generally approved for all the good things he said, and his biblical scholarship was unmatched. And then everyone kind of knew that he had these ideas that no one followed. But then he became a little bit toxic, and it was a bit like today. Suddenly, if you had praised Origen any time in your past, that was dredged up, so people would try to cancel you. And then they tried to say, well, I was young, I didn't know, you know.
It was like an Origen Me Too movement. Thank you very much. I'm going to keep going because I want to get all the callers who are with us on with Dr. Pepino before we have to go. Dr. John Pepino is our guest. He's teaching a free course online coming up, the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers. You can take it at the Institute of Catholic Culture.org. Stephen is in Houston, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Stephen, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Pepino.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Pepino. It's a very simple question. I always hear that, you know, on the radio it says you should read the Church Fathers or learn about the Church Fathers. I don't know where exactly do we go or what books to refer to in order to read about the Fathers. Can you recommend something? Thank you.
Yes, I'm very glad you asked that question, because that is the question. Okay. People who are not scholars, not university people, and they want to find out about something, well, where do I go? And I'm going to answer your question, because I asked myself the same question when I was setting up this course. And I think there's a series of Wednesday afternoon audiences that Pope Benedict XVI gave in 2007, 2008. And he took a bunch of Wednesdays in succession to discuss individual fathers of the church. And these have been gathered. So, for example, for those of you who are watching this, I'll show you, this is the first volume. This is the Our Sunday Visitor edition, which I don't think is in print anymore. And you can see here, there he is. There's our former Pope Benedict XVI. And it's been republished by Ignatius Press. And that's the book that we're actually using, under the title simply, Pope Benedict XVI, Church Fathers, From Clement of Rome to Augustine. So that takes us to about the year 430 AD. And then he continued talking about fathers and then medieval theologians, and that is put together again at Ignatius Press, Church Fathers and Teachers, from St. Leo to Peter Lombard. So St. Leo is Pope in about 450. So it picks up right after Augustine. And it takes us even into the scholastics. And they're short little chapters. It's just Wednesday audience, after all. And Benedict XVI, being such a brilliant reader, theologian, and reader of the Fathers, he really gives you a very personal assessment, and I would say a very grounded and sound judgment of each of the Fathers. Now, the title of the book is The Fathers. Of course, he himself did not give its title, but in there you will find a couple of general audiences on Origen, even. So he does include even people we would call ecclesiastical writers as opposed to church fathers. He even has Tertullian in here, the one who ended up leaving the Catholic Church, slamming the door even. in his early works, he had some very good things to say.
So, Stephen,
as Eusebius, and has all sorts. Yes.
If you just, I'm sure, if you just looked at any Catholic bookstore, ask for Pope Benedict the Fathers, you'll get it, or search online for Pope Benedict the Fathers, and you will find it. Thank you, Stephen, very much. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with our guest, Dr. John Pepino, and we'll continue the conversation about the Church Fathers. Who were they? What they do? Why they matter? More right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN offers the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass live every morning at 8 Eastern and provides you with daily readings to follow along and enrich your experience. To be sure you don't miss out on the daily Mass or to get access to previous recordings, we can send a link to your email inbox every day. It's easy. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Institute of Catholic Culture just does so many great things, and now they've got another one for you. Patristics 102. Patristics 101 is over, so just deal with it. You'll have to wait till it comes around again. But Patristics 102 is coming up. If you sign up by tomorrow, you can get in. It's free. The Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, Institute of Catholic Culture.org. The teacher for the course is our guest, Dr. John Pepino. Maybe you should just tell me real quick before I get back to the callers, what does that mean, Nicene Fathers?
Yes, I'm glad you asked it because I wanted to point that out. Although, before I answer the question, I want to make something clear. The 101 class is archived and available. And
I didn't know that.
You can take it as a self-paced course and take the quizzes and the final exam. So you can still, it's not too late to see little old me and read the fathers along. It's all there.
Okay.
Now, yes, what do we mean? It sounds like a weird incantation, anti-Nicene, post-Nicene. Okay. What we mean by that is this. It refers to the watershed moment, or one of them, but in the history of Christianity, really, which is the first ecumenical council held in the town of Nicaea in the year 325. It's also called the Council of the 318 Bishops. And that is the council at which the Nicene Creed was hammered out. And it was the first time the church, after the persecutions were over, thanks to the victory of Constantine, whom Eastern Christians call Saint Constantine, equal to the apostles, when he moved to make Christianity legal, and then he did everything in his power, in fact, to promote the church, and he built a bunch of churches and favored the bishops and things, and he, in fact, footed the bill for this coming together in the open of all the bishops to discuss the first question, who is Christ? And that is where they said, well, Christ is fully God and fully man, consubstantial with the Father. That was it. And so before the Nicene Fathers, we tend to be reading, before the Council of Nicaea, we tend to read fathers who lived in the shadow of persecution, somewhat split around the Mediterranean. Aww. Sometimes they could communicate, sometimes they couldn't. But after the church is granted legal recognition by the empire and then has this great Council of Nicaea that sets that down, he's fully man and fully God, then you have the Nicene Fathers, those who attended or who lived at the same time, and then the post-Nicene Fathers are all the fathers after that. So that's why in collections of writings of the fathers, you'll often have it divided into series. First series, the ante, meaning before, Nicene, ante, Nicene Fathers, second series, Nicene and post-Nicene Fathers. That's kind of how we divide it. It's a neat division. Now, in terms of numbers, there are many more fathers at and after Nicaea than before, not only because there's more centuries, but also because there are more Christians, you know, to draw from, to have people, and also because of the what is termed the peace of the church, meaning the church is no longer persecuted. Bishops don't have to run into the forest or have their heads cut off or be burnt. They have more time to reflect and write. And now you have a more theological reflection on the givens of revelation and tradition.
You can take that course. Just sign up at instituteofcatholicculture.org. I'm going to go back to the phones, get some more questions here on the Church Fathers for our guest, Dr. John Pepino. Andrew is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Andrew, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, good afternoon. God's blessings on you, Dr. Pepino, and the staff there at CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome. The question is, it's a difficult one for me to address, but I'll try to paraphrase. I read once, probably from a church father, that you can drive the Christians out from a region or a country, but then wait till you see what happens, which isn't good. I'm trying to find out, I've read about so many fathers. I wonder who said that. Can you shed some light on that?
So stay on the line, because I want to ask you questions about this. Do you mean to say, is it the famous quotation that says, the more you mow down Christians, the more they grow? The blood of Christians is their seed? Or something else?
No, it's the opposite. And I'm troubled by the question, but it helps me when I look at like a country like Syria, understand it, what happens when you drive Christians out of a region. And I don't know who said it, and I'm just searching.
No,
so it's really the opposite of what you just stated, Doctor.
I wish I had an answer for you right away. There are fathers who say that, I think it's Athenagoras who says that the Christians are the soul of the world. And so if you drive out the Christians, the world kind of, or that area kind of loses its soul. But I don't know if he goes so far as to say, if you drive out the Christians, everything, you know, will become bad and evil and so forth. I wish I could give you a direct answer there. I don't know it. Thank you for calling. And I will say this. I've been to Sioux Falls many times, and it's a town I really enjoy visiting, particularly that diner right downtown, the Shiny Diner, we call it. But yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't answer your question more precisely.
But you did get a good review on your town. So, Andrew, thanks for the call. I'm going to keep moving. I want to get as many questions answered as I can before we have to go. We'll go to Mary in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. Please wait to the end of your call, Mary, to get Dr. Pepino's review on Grand Rapids, Michigan. Go ahead with your question. Oh, sorry. Don't go ahead yet. I got to push play. Go ahead. Now you can ask your question, Mary. Sorry.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. My question is just, of all these fathers, what would the professor consider the one who had the reputation of being most persuasive and convincing in converting, you know, people who are lukewarm about the faith, even heretics? Who of all these writers had the reputation of really bringing people into the church? They were convinced.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And it kind of depends on the audience in some ways. I think St. Augustine did, through his writings, bring people in. Another one before him would be St. Athanasius, particularly through his life of St. Anthony. It's surprising to us moderns to hear this. Through his life of St. Anthony, he opened St. Anthony, the hermit, you know. In this book, it was written in Greek, but promptly translated into Latin. This would be 360s, maybe. It offered to everyone the possibility of getting to a higher level, because what did it take to convert people at the time? Now, early in the church, what really converted most people was prophetic preaching and miracles and exorcisms. Okay, that's just a fact. And you see it with St. Justin, martyr. And sometimes there's a period in this, the second century, a lot of writers are actually writing to the Roman emperor to convert him, and they use arguments from reason. And they also, and by the way, you yourself with your own eyes, I'm sure, have seen demons exorcised in the name of Jesus. So you know the power of Christ. So it kind of went without saying that you could see miracles going on. And even the conversion, by the way, of the Indies by the Spanish relied to some extent on miracles and exorcisms. You can read Francisco de Vitoria on that for the 1500s even. So that's one way. But then after the Council of Nicaea, once the church is established, the martyrdoms convert a lot of people too. Then what convinces a lot of the elites of the empire is showing how Christianity gives the answers to the questions that philosophy poses. And that was very effective. And you see that, in fact, what converted Augustine himself was a book by Cicero, which we've lost, called the Hortensius, which is a call to philosophy that called him to ask himself the fundamental questions. And then after that, he came to the Bible. He was first disappointed, but ultimately to the preaching of St. Ambrose, which converted St. Augustine. And then St. Augustine, through his pastoral work as a bishop and through his writings, brought people in, not only from paganism, but also he brought them in from the various heresies that existed in North Africa. So I would say maybe St. Augustine, really. And then later on, of course, you have the great missionaries to the barbarians, but that's a different story.
Mary, what do you think?
Of St. Augustine, which of his works would you think was most convincing?
It might be his works against. So if you look at his works against the Donatists or against the Manichaeans, you'll see some things there. Against specific heresies of his own day. Yeah. But I don't want to give you one, because so many come to mind. Saint Irenaeus, going back earlier, he's writing in the 180s. He has a massive book against the heresies in which he shows you how if you depart from the apostolic tradition as found in the Catholic Church, you end up with every possible crazy error. And he kind of lampoons those various errors a bit in the first chapters of his work against the heresy. So that's St. Irenaeus. But ultimately, Mary, the reason why I'm kind of skirting around and thinking of all these different fathers and not giving you the answer of the one book to go and buy to convert your pagan friend or whatever, is that we don't have polls on who came in and when. I mean, we have the books and we can see how convincing they are. But we don't necessarily know what brought people in. And sometimes the people with a reputation for converting a lot, I'm thinking of St. Gregory Thaumaturgus, the wonder worker, disciple of Origen, who went into the middle of Turkey. We know he converted whole regions, but we don't have much of what he wrote. Do you see what I mean? So it doesn't necessarily go hand in hand that we have the book that provides the answers for converting people.
Okay, Mary.
Yes, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad. Thank you, Mary.
I'm interested in that life of St. Anthony because I don't know it, but so this was the one that got people understanding an understanding of a possibility of monastic life and all that?
That's exactly right, yeah. And St. Augustine recounts how he heard of it from hearing two civil servants of the empire. I think they were traveling back from wherever the capital was, maybe Trier, or the capital moved around, discussing this book and how they were going to themselves try to go out and live the monastic life.
Oh,
and that,
wow.
That's what led him to make the decision. And then the fruit of that is that when he went back to North Africa, he lived a quasi-monastic life and wrote in a long letter, I think it's Epistle 252, what amounts to a rule which is at the origin of what we now know as the rule of St. Augustine, the Augustinian rule, which the canons regularly use.
Our guest has been Dr. John Pepino. Dr. Pepino, thank you so much. I couldn't have enjoyed that hour more. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. I'd like to do it again.
And I hope lots of people will take you up on the offer to take the course for free at the instituteofcatholicculture.org. You got to sign up by tomorrow, though. instituteofcatholicculture.org. Coming up next, Father Matthew Spencer, Ask a Priest on Catholic Answers Live.